This is Find a Way. Welcome to part two of my conversation with Mike O'Malley. After I released episode two with Jordan, I got some feedback from some of our listeners requesting a break after an hour. Well, with Mike, we just so happened to have a natural break at the 45-minute mark. So I'm going to see what it's like to have a two-part episode. I hope you like it. I'm so glad you're back because the second half of the conversation, I learned so much. I think it's going to be really important to the future of the show. And I'm so glad you're going to hear it. Thanks for being here. Enjoy.
It's like not going big enough.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. That there's this like.
I don't know. It's not an insecurity probably, but it's like a.
It seems like it though,
I'm
right?
A local artist, so like I just do small pieces, so that maybe they can sell better. But. I don't know. Like. 90% of the time when I like see a cool painting somewhere that's out, that's done by a local person, my thought is like, I wish this was 10 times bigger.
Mm.
It would be so much more awesome. No, I think that there's something about the quantity of the size.
Sure.
That definitely affects the experience of it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There's also maybe it's similar to like that idea of like I'm putting on a tie because I think this is an important thing. Like the size of the canvas is almost like a gesture towards the confidence that the artist has in making this piece.
Yeah.
Whereas like if it's just a little tiny thing, like it's like, oh, I don't know, it's just
sure.
I'm only a weekend painter and just do, you know, here and there. Right?
Yeah, I see what you're talking about. It's funny, when I am able to take part in Ricky Kendall's song a week prompt.
Oh, yes.
That he does.
Yeah.
I find very often I just end up writing a very short song. You know, I end up writing like a minute and a half song or something like that.
Yeah.
Whereas when I just write a song, very often those songs end up being very long songs. I usually write like 4.5-5 minute long songs.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think that there's an odd, I've encountered some, it's not feedback. It's almost just like, knee-jerk reactions to like, wow, you really write long songs, you know, kind of reactions to like, boy, that one went on for some time. Not necessarily like this is bad,
yeah,
but sort of like I've played some solo sets before where I've got 20 minutes and I, you know, my first song is very often my opening song is this like 9-minute long song.
Yeah.
And when I get done with the set, I'll think to myself, like, wow, I played 3 songs tonight. You know, it's kind of like a wild, but it's the same amount of time I played. You know, I could have played 10 songs in 20 minutes, you know?
Yeah, totally.
But, yeah, I don't know.
I wonder if there's a parallel there. Like, you take your practice more seriously because they're longer.
Well, and so maybe that's the pushback against your argument is I feel like those songs are long because it's just I'm not done saying what I need to say yet, right?
Yeah.
But with Ricky's prompts, generally I think because there's a time limit, you know, I've got 1 week to do this.
Yeah.
I figure out a way to say what I want to say short. You know, in a short amount of time. And maybe it's...
Yeah.
Maybe it's just those parameters, you know. With an artist, they start on a smaller piece of canvas, and so they have to figure out how to say what they want to say on that small piece of canvas. And it might take somebody to prompt them to say, hey, I like your style. Do something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it's true. Well, I'm saying it now.
All right.
Out into the world.
Official Michael Malley challenge.
If you're a local painter and your canvas is smaller than 5 feet by 7 feet,
ooh,
you're doing it wrong.
Whoa. I don't think I can endorse that, but I can support your challenge,
though. Yeah. Yeah.
You're doing it wrong.
That might be a little harsh, but
no, I appreciate, you know, going extreme to get results.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone's got to do it. I think we've got like a couple of good challenging thoughts here. You know, like it's funny that in the spirit of this, like, find a way, we're also finding the value of like parameters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you want bigger art. And it's funny that you want it. I like that that's your mentality toward it. I am intimidated by big pieces of art merely from a financial standpoint, because the big pieces are always more expensive.
It's true.
And I would love to have a bigger art budget. You know, there was a time when Audrey and I set aside money every month for art.
Love that.
And we just can't do that anymore. You know, as much, I don't think we do it at all, actually.
Yeah.
A lot of the art that we have now, or anything new that we're getting, we're like inheriting, or we're coming across, or, but the stuff that we can afford to buy is generally smaller.
You know,
little bits. Mm-hmm. I've had to figure out a way to enjoy those, you know, to say, like, I recognize that what I'm buying is not ideal.
Yeah.
You know? And so I have to think to myself, oh, for example, at the last Spring Arts Festival that I went to.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was this year. There was an artist who had some really beautiful watercolors, and they were mostly like flowers, cactus, things like that.
Great.
Gorgeous, gorgeous pieces. And it just had like a certain life to it that I really appreciated. I couldn't afford any of the paintings,
yeah,
but I bought some greeting cards that she had there that were like $4 or something. Right. Mm-hmm. And they're big greeting cards, you know, and my plan is to frame them. You know, of course, my brain being the way it is, I still haven't done it. It's been like 6 months, but not 6 months, but it's been a couple months.
Yeah.
Haven't framed them yet. But I thought to myself, like, would I rather never look at this stuff again? Or would I rather have just this smaller representation?
Some record of it. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And maybe that's a different kind of lens to use in evaluating art that not to be overly crass, but like it's a commodity, right?
In
that sense, right? You're looking at it as something of like, well, I want to have this.
I want to
own it and buy it and pay for it and
look at it.
And if it's too big, then that's a hurdle there. I don't know. That's legit.
Let me ask a different question, or like sort of a side question, unless you're not done with that thought.
No,
I want to stop it.
I could be done.
What are your thoughts about ownership of art? And let me sort of explain what I'm talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'm just realizing where I got this concept. It doesn't delegitimize it, but it is kind of funny. But are you familiar with the Harry Potter stories?
I have a cursory knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's one element of the story, I think it's in like the last book maybe, or one of the last books.
Okay.
There's an element of the story where there's an item. It's a sword.
Okay.
And it was made by dwarves.
Sure.
And it's an ancient famous sword. It was owned by this like famous wizard, this famous wizard paid for it to be made or something like that. And that wizard died and left the sword to someone else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, Rowling explains that in dwarf culture, I'm pretty sure it's dwarves, maybe it's a different race, I'm not sure, but yeah. in this culture, they don't believe in ownership in this way.
Sure.
To them, they made the sword, they own the sword, but this wizard that paid them for it paid to like have it for his life, but when he dies it should go back to them because they made it. Right. And for some reason this really struck me.
Yeah.
And I find myself cottoning to the logic. I find myself thinking like, yeah, if I painted something and I sold that thing to someone,
yeah,
I do feel as though like it's hard for me to let go of that thing. You know, the nice thing about music is I make a song, I can put it on a disc and I still have the song,
right?
You know, I still have the tracks.
Totally.
If I have some paintings that I've made that I really cherish and it would be so hard for me to sell them. Mm. But if I thought, well, I'll sell them until, you know, if they don't want them anymore, I get it back. Or if they die, I get it back.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, whatever. And I'm laughing at myself now because I'm realizing that I'm having this like shift of belief system based on
Harry Potter
yeah. book.
I mean,
but I'm just great. Wondering, like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting concept. I wonder how a painter truly would feel about that. We're talking, you know, in that context of paintings, and maybe you could extend that to any sort of crafts person or someone that's creating something out in the world.
Right.
But using painting as the example, I could see a line of thought that would say, first of all, that maybe when the painting is happening, that it's almost as if that person isn't really doing the painting, like that there's some other kind of artistic entity or force that's coming through them to do the painting.
Sure.
And
yes.
So in, you know, you hear people, artists talk about like, I'm not doing this. I'm just the steward of this thing that's happening.
That's right.
And this is the end product. And so from that perspective, it wouldn't make sense for it to sort of revert back to the ownership or whatever of the artist, because if they never had it to begin with, it was made to be out in the world and to,
I love that,
you know?
Yes. Yeah.
So maybe that's one possibility. And I think that there is an element of like, people creating something to be experienced by other people.
Right.
And so that they wouldn't want it to come back to themselves. They would, you know, let it keep going, be out there and be inherited. But it's an interesting concept, just the whole kind of ownership. I mean, indigenous communities have, I think, a much healthier view of owning, certainly when it comes to like land.
Yeah.
And like, what does it mean to own something? Like, you have dominion over it. I guess just icky and colonialist. And
yeah, right.
I think that probably there's a much healthier posture towards owning everything, or thinking about the concept of ownership, which is like, yeah, maybe more of a stewardship, recognizing that you're in this flow of humanity. Like, there's people who have come before you who have given you stuff. There's people who are going to come after you, who you're going to give your stuff to.
Right.
So like, yeah, you've got it now, but like, what does it really mean to own it? Like,
sure.
You're just keeping it good for the next group.
Yeah. I very much agree with that. I think that that's a much healthier way to look at it. I appreciate when we can break something down into sort of like an all or nothing thing. It's like either, like, we either own everything, which means we owe our stewardship to everything. You know, if we own it, it means we should take care of it. Or we don't own it and we're just here temporarily and there is nothing that can be owned. It sort of equals the same thing in the end. Like, we are going to leave it behind. yeah. regardless.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do we owe each other as far as...
Well, I think part one of the, maybe to complicate that, to say if you own it, that means you own it. So you could do whatever the heck you want with it. Mm. So like if you decide to not care for it or to destroy it, like it doesn't matter, it's yours, you own it. Mm. Versus like if you have a just a different framework of what ownership means, that you're just caring for it, recognizing that it's not, you're not the only person in the equation, that there's others that are gonna
yeah.
get it after you.
So to be the other side of this tennis match, then, to further complicate it, like, does destroying it necessarily mean you've done a wrong, right? Like let's say a generation, we'll do a hypothetical. Let's say that there's a, you know, a possibility that somebody might destroy the earth, right? Like, yeah, maybe it's, like, happening sure. right now. Maybe...
I recently watched Oppenheimer for the first time.
There we go. Right.
So, yeah. Uh-huh. There's a chance.
Does that destruction... Where are the boundaries of the negativity go with that destruction, right? Like, if it's destroyed, does it just mean that it's cleared a canvas for something new?
Mm-hmm.
Even if it means that the thing that paints on the new canvas isn't of the same ilk of those who destroyed yeah. it.
Right.
You know,
who's to determine that?
Right.
Or even, yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Ha!
One thing that comes to mind is the thinking about destroying things is the Banksy. Mm. Have you heard about this?
I loved that. Yes.
Where the
you read my mind. That was, yeah.
It was a painting. I think it was a painting, relatively small painting, frankly. You know, when I saw that, I was like, come on, man.
Come on, Banksy.
It's dumb. But the second the auction was closed, triggered the shredding of the thing.
Yeah. What a
and
move.
And I mean, it was performative, right? It was encapsulated by the structure itself, so it was, you know, that was part of the artwork itself, and right. maybe it was even more valuable now that it
that's
had
what
been
I was,
shredded.
Yeah, it's, so it only increased the value.
It's part of the you know, you can't escape the economic calculus. It's always already part of
which is made up.
Yeah, oh, know? Totally. Yeah. Well,
the value right. of the art is just
yes.
Yeah. I was talking to someone the other day about the Orson Welles documentary F is for Fake. Oh. And it's just about it's about a lot of things, but it focuses on an expert forger who can paint forgeries that are so good that nobody can tell the difference.
Yeah.
Even, you know, when given, you know, once to choose from a panel of experts, like none of them could tell the difference, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, this forger is told, like, you're not an artist. You're just copying other people's
right.
stuff. And
right.
you want to say, like, it's an art form.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
What I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know, this forgery. And if I can do it so well that you can't tell the difference, where is the value in this thing? Because you think that Van Gogh touched this thing
yeah.
with his own paintbrush, you
yeah.
know. That's why it's valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the art then. It's not, it's just this story that we told ourselves about this painter, you know. It's such an interesting, and separately, I was having a conversation with my friend David, who was just talking about the practice that I don't know what to call them, the one percenters, the elites, the super rich use with art, which is, you know, as like a tax break.
Oh yeah.
You buy art.
Totally.
And then you stow it away
mm-hmm.
until the artist dies or until something happens with the artist, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then you give it to a museum and it's now, you bought it for $10,000 and now it's worth $150,000 and you give it to a museum and now you get a tax deductible for $150,000.
Totally. Yeah.
It's like, and the only reason why it has that new value to it is because like the hype, the talk, the, you know,
yeah.
whatever it is.
Yeah. The market calculus that it's like, it's a commodity. It's just, it's one of it's a number on a spreadsheet amongst your other investments.
Right.
That, yeah.
But they won't say that. They'll say like, oh, it's one of my favorite pieces.
Right.
Oh, it's really close to my heart, but I'm gonna let this gallery have it, you
right.
know, to share with the world.
Yeah, right. Look at this good thing I'm doing. Right.
Which is...
It is a good thing.
It is. It's, mm-hmm. I'm sure it's beautiful, yeah. you know? And that I think that that's... that really hits the core, like one of the most argumentative aspects that brought me to this podcast is I do have a desire, and I don't plan on indulging in it too much in these interviews, or at least, you know, I probably will, but I don't plan on it. But I do have a desire to dispel this myth that so many of us buy into of like perceived value, right? Hmm. Like, or this myth of like good and bad art.
Oh,
you know,
interesting.
Yeah. This myth of,
yeah.
That I can just leave it at that. Good and bad art. It, you know, some kid sitting down with a sheet of computer paper and some like shitty paints that their parent bought them from Toys R Us or something,
mm-hmm.
and like dipping their fingers in and making nonsense on the page.
Yeah.
There's so much beauty in that.
Totally. There,
it is innocent. It yeah. is, it is some of the few examples of art that is made with pure pleasure in mind, with
right.
pure desire or pure joy
yeah.
behind it.
Mm-hmm.
In comparison to, you know, a troubled painter who's, you know, struggling to get recognition and mm-hmm. maybe dies before they're recognized as brilliant and all yeah. that stuff. Also beautiful.
Yeah.
So such a beautiful thing. Also beautiful is like somebody who's like, I just want to get through my life. I just want to get paid. I'm going to make this painting for Target and then they're going to copy it 50 times or 50,000 times.
Yeah.
But it's going to fund my dream. It's going to fund my ability to, and it probably doesn't actually. Maybe the beauty in this is like how little they get paid for it and how disappointing it, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
It is not the piece of art or the artist or anything that is responsible for the beauty. It's this story that we tell ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so often we get caught up in the argument over the story. Like, this story is the best story. No, this story is the best
totally.
Story.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's always been a fascinating thing for me because it's a question of taste, you might say.
Yes.
Right. People's tastes change over time.
Right.
Like, what does that mean? How is that?
Yeah.
Like, what does that say about the objective quality of good quality of, you know, of high art or whatever?
There can't be one, right?
I think that there is a argument for some sort of consensus, even if it's a loose consensus, that's based off of what's come before, a knowledge of that, a continuation of the practice. And I think... you know, and really across the board with all forms of art, literary arts, visual arts, performing, you can't just show up having never, like if you wanted to be a painter and you want to have some level of acclaim, in theory, you can't never have looked at another painting.
But wouldn't that provide such a unique perspective?
It's a good question.
So when you say that there is an argument to be made,
yeah,
I'm assuming that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the argument that you are making.
Of course.
But it's okay if it is too.
Yeah.
I just mean that, like, of course there's an argument to be made. Sure. It's being made all the time.
Well, and I think, I mean, what's interesting is like, okay, let's say in this thought experiment, there's someone who has lived in a cave and they were like, I'm gonna become a painter. Somehow they figured out what that was. You know, mm-hmm. they were left in this cave with some canvases and some bits of paint, and they created this thing that's a painting, and it comes out. Well, everyone who looks at that painting is gonna be like, oh, that looks like Rothko. Mm-hmm. That looked like we're the
right.
The framework, the calculus we have, like the matrix that's in place, is based off of history of what's come before.
But then there's got to be an equal amount of people who have not taken any time to even learn who Rothko is and go in and say, like, I like this, you know, or I hate this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Maybe music is a better example.
Okay.
Because.
Although I do think the painting in a cave is an interesting one, only because take away the canvas and just use the cave, we have a literal example of this, which is cave paintings.
Totally, yeah.
People who have never looked at art,
mm-hmm.
but discovered it and made it, and now when we look at it, we are in awe of it, right?
Yes, totally. And we look at that and we say, look, this is art.
Right.
I mean, maybe, and right. certainly I've heard people say this before, the people who made those things were not like thinking, we made art. They might not even have had this sense of individualist of we or I, like that whole concept.
Yeah,
so be. I think that, yeah, the cave paintings of those times are like, they're kind of, they've been co-opted, I think.
Right. It's all a story.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a story that we tell. And which is ironic, our experience of it is a story.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why they made it, as far as we can tell, is a story, right?
Sure.
It's, yeah. You know, and of course, there's many theories that there might have been what we would call like religious belief drawn into it, like the idea of painting the bison on the wall was going to make the bison appear, you know, and like,
right.
you know,
sure.
worship this thing that like will now manifest itself, or they will manifest it by painting it, but.
Mm-hmm.
It's still all a story. It's still, you know, it's just a changing story.
Yeah.
As the time goes. So let's go to music, because I think you had a point brewing there that I want to hear.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how productive this really is for the podcast, but
this is
okay.
This is one of the things that made me want to do the podcast the most, is this discussion.
You have someone who's in the cave.
Yes.
Right. But instead of, painting materials, they somehow have access to a wonderfully equipped recording studio and have the knowledge to play a myriad of instruments, and they create some sort of audio, like oral experience that's been recorded.
I think we just came up with a concept for Pauly Shore's return to cinema, but go on.
And how is that going to be received? Because I think with music, it's much more, the way that we judge music is, because I think maybe people are more familiar with music, it's just around more mm-hmm. than visual art is. People are more, it's more ingrained in our culture. And we judge music based on what we've heard before.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to envision someone who has no knowledge of any prior music creating something that would be conceived of as like, oh, I love this. This is great. Presumably it would be totally like non-Western tonal system,
mm-hmm.
like crazy sort of, like what you get with a lot of contemporary, you know, classical music, which is sort of a funny oxymoron, but
right.
Right. Because yeah, I think that with music, people are judging it based on like what I like and what I know.
Yeah.
There's that framework in place.
Sure. Well, I think, what you're this premise that you're putting out there is the exact place I think is probably the most important conversation there is when it comes to art, which is, is it necessary for us to identify the more important experience of art, right? We have the experience of somebody who has put in potentially years, decades of time mm-hmm. studying.
Yeah.
In this case, we'll say music, studying the history of music, mm-hmm. the progression of music, the theory behind music, chord structures, you know, the circle of fifths, whatever you want to go through, like all those things.
Yeah.
And then listens to a piece of music and uses their knowledge and their experience to create an experience for themselves for it. And then therefore dictate, mm-hmm. this is good, this is bad.
Right. Right.
Versus a person who goes in this scenario, to listen to this hypothetical cave rock album,
yeah. uh-huh.
where they can go in with the mentality of like, I'm going to compare this to the Rolling Stones,
mm-hmm.
right? or, you know, whatever. Or I'm going to listen to this because, you know, with the mindset of like, this is the first recording we have of music, right? And like, of course it's going to be alien. Of course it's going to be right. odd.
Yeah.
And so do I enjoy it from that standpoint, as opposed to like, well, this doesn't sound anything like Mick Jagger. You know, this doesn't sound anything yeah. like
Queens of the Stone Age.
Right. Perfect. Oh, it was right there. Oh, you win. Okay, argument over. No, but I mean, I think, like, for example, a couple years back, like a decade back, my friend Travis and I decided to make, his aunt is a massage therapist, and mm-hmm. she asked us to make a ambient album, right?
Cool, yeah.
Which was such a great challenge for us, because... Mm. You know, it was one of those things where it gave us license to break some rules that we don't get to break, you know, like, you know, recording a rainstorm, you know,
and
like
wow.
incorporating it into a song. And like,
that's amazing.
It just, at that time, it felt like we can't do this for real, but if we're doing it for this like ambient mm-hmm. album, like, yeah, let's do that. I've always wanted to do that. Let's do it.
Yeah. You know?
And the, one of the greatest surprises that I experienced making this album one night during a rainstorm. We had just gotten done recording the rainstorm, and after it was over, we were starting to put away the equipment, and the frogs behind his house in this little retention pond all yes. came out, and they, there must have been 100 of them
mm-hmm.
and they all started their song.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we quick got the microphones out again and recorded it for 20 minutes.
Yeah, right? That's incredible.
And it was beautiful. I can remember so many times in my life hearing frogs like that and being like, oh, shut up.
Mm.
You know, like
wow.
trying to watch my show or whatever, trying to go to sleep, yeah. whatever. But this moment, for some reason, we recognized, oh my God, this is just gorgeous, right?
Mm.
So we recorded it, and I got to play. I just kind of got this guy right here, this Juno 60 keyboard, and just played a thing for about 10 minutes over it, and we didn't change a thing. It was just perfect. It was a moment caught in time,
yeah,
and it was great. And I still go back and listen. I listen to that whole album actually all the time, but that song stands out for me as one of my greatest achievements musically, right?
It's amazing, yeah.
But the lesson that it got, that I took from it, and it took maybe a year or two for it to really like sink in, was that those frogs don't know about music, right? They don't know about theory.
Know?
Right. As far as that, they don't know about our concept of music, right? As far as we know.
As far as you know.
Right. Yeah, they might just be keeping quiet about it. But those mm-hmm. frogs, they got together maybe instinctually, maybe without much forethought. They're mm-hmm. just like, the rain's over, time to come out, and it's time to sing, right?
That's what we do. Yeah.
That's right. And they just sang for, like I said, 20 minutes without. They went on even longer than that. We just stopped recording. But they didn't do it to get written up in a magazine.
Right.
They didn't do it to like get laid. Maybe they did actually.
Maybe they
that
did.
Actually yeah. might be the main reason why they did it. Mm-hmm. But it seemed way more like doing it because it felt good, doing it because this is what we do right now. This is,
yeah,
this is how we are.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that one of my complaints about our approach to critique, when it comes to art, is that it pulls us further and further away from what it's really supposed to be about. Right.
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to be painting something to get put up at the Met.
Right.
I'm supposed to be painting something because I am the steward of this passion.
And right? This is who you are right now.
This is who I am right now. Moment. Right.
So,
yeah.
How can you tell from a critic's perspective if someone's doing something because it is just part of their thisness, or if they're doing it because it's, you know, they're an Instagram poet and they're just putting stuff out there to get the likes?
My answer is not an answer to your question, but it's the reason why I can't answer it. I think when I'm the conclusion I'm beginning to, what I think I feel taking hold in me is that I think the critic needs to go. I think I don't mean that people should stop reacting to art.
Yeah.
I think people should stop saying that it's good or bad.
Maybe the authority of the critic needs to be revisited. Because the argument, the discussion should be had. The arguments should be had.
I think what I, for the sake of art reaching its pinnacle in our culture and our society and our species, I think we will have, if, to me at least, and I could be wrong about this, but to me, we will have reached that peak when we stop saying this is good and bad, and we start saying I like this or I don't like this, right? And I think the difference is there cannot be an objective good or bad because our whole reality is not objective. I believe that what you and I experience is built out of a series of choices that are not our own.
Of course, yeah.
And so therefore, my association with even the colors used on a canvas cannot be quantifiable or comparable to yours because, at least with our brains, the limitations of our brains, we cannot sit down and list like, well, I had this red bike that is the same color as this red and I was in a crash and it hurt me, but I also had a really good day on that bike too, but I ended up selling that bike for less than what it was worth. And right. So I'm bitter, but you know, there are so many little variables that go into what sparks joy that I believe it is best for us to abandon good and bad and embrace this sparks joy. Or this hurts me.
What about instead of good and bad, because that's a binary, that's a, you know,
sure, yeah,
that's a black and white. Could there still be, this is better, this is worse? Could there be a directionality?
I think that's a middle, like, I think that's a really great transition, right? Just like,
because part of the, sorry to cut you off, but no. Like part of the, maybe a drawback of I like this, you know, this sparks joy, is that it's no one can say anything to that.
Well, it's not that they can't say anything to it, it's that they can't take it away from you.
Yeah.
Right.
That means you can never, it's not an invitation for further discussion. It's like a statement of this is a reality, this is my whatever.
I disagree. I think there's plenty of room for discussion. It's, I like this because.
Okay.
And I don't like this because.
Yeah.
You know? And if you want to say this is better or worse, I say that that's a good transition because it's almost like a way to soften the blow.
Yeah.
Right?
I think that's what I'm saying. Like that, the I like this because concept is maybe what I was trying to get at for the, like, the directionality of, like, this is better, this is worth, because you could say, I like this because, so, like, I find this to be on the gooder side, or I don't like this because I find this to be towards the badder side.
I think, like, my question back to you, there's a word for that that I'm blanking on right now. My question back to you is, you know, what is the benefit of this is good and this is bad? Like, if I'm looking at this lion up here, right? And my opinion on it has not been voiced yet, right? And so then Mike O'Malley comes and looks at it and says, this is good, this is bad. What is the benefit of you saying that? Like, what good has that done or bad has that done?
I mean, that's a weird question. I think it's part of being a person that you're expressing your observations.
Okay.
You know, for me, if we're kind of using this as an example, I'm coming at this with, you know, a pretty long background in looking at visual art. So, like, I've got stuff to say.
Yeah.
I could talk us through here. You know, we could discuss the different elements, the formal. We could talk about conceptual. I love that there's just kind of this rip right in the middle. I think that's a critical part of the piece.
I did that by accident, actually. That's, I mean, I didn't make this, by the way, just okay, to take off any pressure.
No. I mean, and so, yeah, what good, what's the value, what's the cash value of making an assessment, of making a judgment? I think it's part of being a person in the world. I think that's how we move through. That's how we make, that's how we stay alive, maybe. So maybe there's a biological impulse also. Like, we have to decide, do I like this food? Is this the food I'm going to eat? Do I like, am I going to decide to get up and go to work today so I can make a living to, et cetera, support my family?
Well,
keep the biology going.
And that's a really good point. I do think that there are, I don't think that this mentality that I'm talking about should be applied to just everything, right? When it comes to art,
I think
it should. But when it comes to, like, should I, you know, this poison berry is good or bad is great. I think that's a really helpful thing, right?
Okay, perfect, yeah.
Or at least, like, being able to say, this poison berry is good for making paint, bad for eating, right? But as far as this painting is bad, right, my concern is that that's what brings in like ego to art, right? To where like someone says this painting's bad and I say, oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I must have bad taste, right? Yeah. Or I must not, you know, what this person who has studied art and, like, really has exposed themselves to so much art doesn't like this thing. I think the mistake that is made is that a lot of people adopt that as, like, I need to think like somebody who has seen a lot of art, right? Instead of, my point of view is unique in that I haven't seen a lot of art.
Yeah.
And I like this thing, right? Yeah. Somebody who likes music that I might scoff at, right?
Right.
I could make the argument, well, I've listened to a lot of music. And so over time I've developed a taste and this person hasn't. What am I doing to that person by putting my perspective, which is not theirs, into them?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, could there be an element of kind of going back to that example that I was telling about my friend who was working at the bar with the guy that ordered the burger?
Yes. Yes.
Where there's a possibility of, like, if you know more, you might appreciate
right.
a different type of art, music more. Like, if you like this,
right.
you should try this.
Now, here's the interesting part of that, or at least here's something that I think I hope, right? Although you might disagree. is the best case scenario, taking your friend at the bar, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is the best case scenario that that guy leaves the restaurant and never orders another well-done burger again?
Mm-hmm.
Or is the best case scenario that guy leaves the restaurant able to enjoy both a well-done hamburger and a medium hamburger?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know.
Right.
I mean, I think that the reality is that he's got a story now.
Yeah.
And maybe it depends on the intensity of the epiphany.
Mm, yeah.
Like if the medium hamburger was legitimately that much better,
yeah,
to just ridiculously overshadow the taste possibilities that you're getting from the well-done burger.
Right.
Then yeah, he's never going back.
Right.
I think maybe holistically the best case scenario is an overall expansion of like, I can now appreciate more things.
Right.
Rather than I can appreciate only the better things.
Right. That, and I
think, did I fall into your trap?
No, no. I mean, yes, I guess that is the launching point or the center point of what I'm wanting to know. That's what,
yeah,
this is why I'm talking. This is why I want to talk about this.
Yeah.
Is that as of right now, and I'm seeking conversations and I'm seeking perspective so that I can learn more.
Mm-hmm.
But as of right now, it is my belief or my feeling that my life is better when I enjoy things.
Yeah.
You know, like,
right.
I spent a good chunk of my life being a snob about music, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I've had so many instances where I've been reluctant,
yeah,
to try something out because, like, Wilco's a great example of that. When I was in college, Wilco was so popular,
yeah,
and I was like, well, fuck Wilco. I'm not listening to Wilco.
Totally, yeah.
And somebody sat me down and said, we're going to sit and listen to Ghost is Born, and you're going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
And we listened to it, and I was like, this is shit. I don't like it.
Yeah.
And so that was it.
Yeah.
Same thing with the Shins. Somebody sat me down with... I think it was Shoots Too Narrow. It was the one before it. Either way, I was determined, like, everybody likes this, so I'm not going to like it,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
one day, I got a chance to go see, I can't remember, I think I was going to go see Bon Iver, and Wilco was playing with Bon Iver.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, well, I'll go see Bon Iver and listen to Wilco.
Right.
Bon Iver was great. Wilco blew my mind.
Dang.
And I went back, I found Kicking Television, fell in love.
Mm.
Then I listened to Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. Oh my God, what is this? This is amazing.
Yeah.
Listen to Ghost is Born again. Voila. Love it.
Yeah.
It's great, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all I was left with was, oh, all these years. All these years I avoided this. All these years, you know, I could have been anticipating the next album. Mm-hmm. I could have been,
wow,
you know,
right,
whatever.
Yeah.
And who, you know, now I look at that and I say, okay, who cares? That was my, I learned a lesson. Wilco taught me this great lesson, you
yeah
know? And so that's built in me, you know? My most recent version of that is Taylor Swift. I avoided the hell out of Taylor Swift.
Sure.
And it hit me one day when I was at the gym, as Shake It Off was playing,
mm-hmm,
and I was like, I like this song.
Mm-hmm.
This is like making me feel something.
Yeah.
I'm motivated. I'm like running harder. I'm, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And so then I looked it up and I listened to it in the car. And then I thought, like, I guess I could listen to this album.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so then I listened to the album. Beautiful album. Wonderful.
Yeah.
It's still not like, it's not like it's my top 50 even.
Sure.
But it's a great album. It's,
yeah,
a, you know, and so, all right. And then all of a sudden I'm thinking, well, now I got to try Billie Eilish.
Mm.
Fucking Billie Eilish blows my mind. Incredible stuff. And I only see like a positive trend with this, like, all right, why am I avoiding this stuff?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that there's an element of like the best critics out there are the ones that are the most omnivorous and are the ones that can show you the way to appreciate anything.
Ah, you're, this right? is it. This is it.
I'm thinking of like a couple examples. It's taken me a little while to appreciate him, but I really like Anthony Bourdain.
Right.
He's a great writer. I think that's kind of what made me realize like he's an unbelievable writer.
Yeah.
And in one of his shows, he goes to Waffle House. And it was like the first, he'd never been to Waffle House before. And he's with like Sean Brock or something, some famous chef from the South. And he's like talking about how, you know, this is like, it's Waffle House. It's the worst. It's like the lowest quality trash. And he's eating this food and he's like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
This is like legit.
Yes.
I love this. I love this experience.
Totally.
And so, yeah, someone like that who's like been across the world, had every type of cuisine from the highest possible echelons of, you know, the best chefs to Waffle House,
right?
Right? Is that that's the low point?
Yes.
Those are the people who, yeah, I think are the best ambassadors. Another example is like, you know, when I was a bartender in Chicago and we were making like these really fancy cocktails, at the end of the day, what I wanted after at the end of the shift is a Miller High Life.
Yeah.
That's the best possible thing for me at that time. And so, yeah, I think an appreciation across the spectrum is really, I don't know, it's a mark of something. Maybe that's, maybe it's a mark of humility.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a mark of receptivity. Those two things certainly are critical parts of humanity.
Yeah.
So maybe it's part of being a human that you can like kind of let that weird cultural ego critique go and be like, I love everything. But I love some things at certain times and other things at other times. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to rank order them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you're hitting the nail on the head. At least like for where I'm at, I'm just thrilled at the perspective that you're bringing into this, because you're helping me see my perspective even better.
Mm.
Or my own, like sort of my journey here. The you coming out and just saying like the more omnivorous the critic, the better.
Yeah.
That is a major thing for me.
Yeah.
I'm so tired of the, I hate everything, therefore trust me.
Oh, totally.
Mentality.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also this approach of, and this is what Find a Way means to me, is that I feel as though we owe it to ourselves, not just like I owe it to myself, and I also owe it to my friends, my family, the establishments that I go to, the artists that I experience and things like that. I owe it to them to seek a way to enjoy our experience together, right? And
yeah.
So if I go to a Waffle House,
yeah,
there's a way for me to enjoy that, just mm-hmm. like Anthony Bourdain found a way to enjoy it. And
yeah.
I didn't see the episode, but whatever he did, he figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
He went, even though it's got this, you know, to him, a reputation that is like lowest of the low,
yeah,
there's a way to enjoy it, right?
Totally.
And there's a way for me to, like, I'm sure every restaurant in this town, even though it's, you know, I don't think we have any Michelin star restaurants around, maybe we do, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
but even though they might not be one, there's something there. There's an item on the menu. There's a seat in the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
There's somebody who's in my company.
Yeah.
There's a server there that's going to make me enjoy this.
Yeah,
right.
Totally.
And that's what I seek. That's what I seek. And that's where the ranking has no place for me there.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I want to do is say, I liked this.
Mm-hmm.
This is good.
Yeah.
I like this because, I'm here with Mike O'Malley in my little office.
Yeah.
You know, drinking a beer
right.
on a Thursday afternoon.
It's incredible.
This is the way I enjoy this.
Can I give a counterpoint to
course.
The whole concept?
Of course. This is, yeah, this is what I'm
Isn't the possibility that you can find a way, that you can always see the bright side, the possibility, isn't this just a mark of privilege and an indicator of how our lives have been relatively easy and that we've been cared for in a way that has allowed us to have that standpoint to like look for, you know, to change our perspective and be like, well, there's always something good about this. Like, are we operating from a baseline of comfort and, you know, moderate wealth even?
So, I mean, I think there's an element of that. I don't think that there is, I don't think that, I can't think of any existence where, it's hard to think of an existence where there isn't some form of desire for pleasure,
mm-hmm.
right? Or desire for joy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so when it comes to our existence, I certainly am not prescribing a lifestyle where there cannot be any negative.
Mm-hmm.
This would counter, I mean, the negative is sometimes what makes the positive so good, right?
Sure.
So there's going to be bad meals. There's going to be bad company. There's going to be bad discussions. There's going to be, I will fail to find the good frequently.
Yeah.
Right. My perspective is that I owe it to all those, you know, to myself, my friends, my family, the people around me. I owe it to seek the good. Right.
Yeah.
No matter what station in life I'm at, right? If I'm in the worst case scenario, if I'm
right,
you know, who knows? I mean, I could come up with some like god awful scenarios. I don't believe it's okay to be miserable as long as I'm seeking joy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that just helps me exist. That just kind of helps me with, when I say find a way, that's a really good compass for me.
Yeah.
You know, so that like if I'm poor and I don't have a home and I don't have possessions, which sometimes sounds really nice, but I understand that that's from a position of privilege for sure.
Sure, yeah.
But if I am in a situation along those lines, it doesn't mean that my life isn't worth joy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not... I want to find that. I think when you first posited that, the first thing that popped in my mind was my grandfather, my mom's dad, who,
is this,
you know,
Bop?
No, different.
Oh, okay.
This is Grandpa.
Grandpa.
Right.
Sweet.
James, who I'm named after. My first name is James.
Oh, far
as enough. You've discovered last week.
That's right. Yeah.
But you know, like all of my grandparents, they lived through the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And, my grandfather is a brilliant man, and you know, by the end of his life had, you know, done what a lot of people from his generation did, which is like create, you know, establish, you know, some wealth that he came from nothing, and he established, you know, some wealth and put himself through college and did all these great things. Despite his comfort that he, you know, he, along with many helpful government programs and, you know, support and things like that, but this life that he sort of crafted for himself and his family, despite that comfort, he, you know, every time we went to a restaurant, if he got coffee, he would put half a pack of sugar in his coffee and then he'd roll up the pack and he'd put it in his pocket. Right. And this was, you know, obviously from his time in the Depression, sugar was just this like commodity you don't waste.
Mm-hmm.
He had whole big, huge bags of sugar in his house, you know, but
He
would, the next time we went out, when he got coffee, he would not grab a packet of sugar. He would grab the half packet from his pocket
that he brought with
and
him.
He'd unroll it and put it in there. He loved that.
Yeah.
There was just something about
yeah.
that devotion to being honorable,
that's cool.
I guess, or, you know, not wasting. Mm-hmm. And so even for him, I see that as like a way that he found to sort of honor that struggle that he went through, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of what I mean, you know, sort of more like, it doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't have to, I think it kind of transcends all, levels of existence. Is just like, I think the thing that drives us, even at a molecular level, you know, or
yeah,
I don't know if I can speak for that, but like even a tiny little microorganism, I think is driven by like some form of joy, you know, how do I enjoy being in this petri dish, you know, or whatever I, you know,
yeah. Who knows? You're not looking to find a way by offering the solution.
Right.
You're just looking to remain in the circumstance while still using what's available to have that possibility of.
Right. I do think that there are elements that help though. Right. Like, and that's why I make the argument that critique can be harmful for this drive. Right. Mm-hmm. Because if we're finding ways to take away someone's love, like if somebody says Waffle House is my favorite restaurant, I don't think it's somebody's job to say like, you should stop eating there.
Right.
You need to go to this Michelin star restaurant. I think the job is to figure out, like your friend did at that bar.
Yeah.
How do I introduce a new thing to increase pleasure or increase joy and understanding?
Yeah.
Without taking away the previous one. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I pose all of this. I know I'm saying it as an argument. I know I'm saying it with some vigor, but I do want to know if I'm wrong. You know, I do want to know, like, does the quality over quantity equation matter here? You know, does, and like, does me challenging this tradition of critique, am I taking away somebody's fun? You know, like Mike O'Malley, who is learned in the world of art, am I taking away fun when you know want to sit and talk about this piece? I want us to talk about it, and maybe this is like a compromise I need to make. Maybe when somebody says this is good, I need to learn to translate it to I like this, instead of saying like excuse me,
right,
there's no objective good or bad, you know,
right, that yeah kind of thing. sure yeah. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I've got two thoughts. The first is, are you familiar with Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning? Have you read this book?
No.
This is what he talks about.
Oh, okay.
He's was someone who was in one of the Nazi concentration camps, and you know, one of the points of the book is like, the one thing that you can't have taken away from you is your decision to still have hope.
Yes.
Or joy, maybe. You know, maybe there's a two sides to that, to the same coin. In the most awful and dire, horrific circumstances.
Right.
Right. Like maybe to an extreme. So that was one thing I was thinking about.
Okay.
With the Frankl connection. The other thing is like, when I'm looking at a piece of art, like, you know, we're looking at this lion here together, I've got a lot to say about it. And that's a critique for sure. That's a judgment that I'd be passing as making these observations, because I'd be pointing like to different directions, like, okay, it's a lion, so you know, we're there's a reference there. It looks like maybe it was spray painted. I could see that it's kind of maybe faded a little bit. Maybe one part is more in the shade most of the time, and what does that mean for the actual meaning of the painting, et cetera, et cetera. But what I'm, and I think maybe this is the hopefully like the omnivorous critic would have this posture also. I'm saying this, but my statement doesn't end with a period. It's like, here it is now, like, change my mind.
Yeah, now you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
That's what I love that. Yeah.
And maybe it's critical. Maybe I'm saying, like, it looks like someone was practicing here and that they were kind of learning how to use a stencil for the first time. And so they just kind of built this makeshift frame with maybe an old bed sheet across the thing for a canvas. And, like, you know, it was just a red can of spray paint. But that's cool. Not really doing much for me, but
right.
That's where I'm at with it. And then maybe you'd come back and be like, well, in fact, this isn't spray paint. This is the blood of their beloved cat that they put into a spray container. And the cat, you know, gesturing towards the depth of a lion heritage is, you know,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. And in that case, like, dang, love that. That's incredible. Yeah. And in many ways, that's like the reality of contemporary art, that, like, no one, this is a blanket statement, but I think it's mostly reality, can approach a piece of contemporary art and just from the aesthetic, like, formal analysis, make an accurate judgment.
Right.
Because, and this is kind of maybe a statement of where art is, or where it has been, at least in the last couple of decades, there's always layers of depth where, like, you need a knowledge, you need an understanding of the artist's background, of what exactly the material is, of, like, what the context of the institutional presentation of this work,
yeah,
to even have any idea what's going on. And so I think that what's kind of cool is that artists have been on board with what you're saying, and the direction of art, certainly contemporary visual art, has been to complicate the thumbs up, thumbs down level of, like, formal critique, like, this is good, this is bad, by just doing crazy weird stuff.
Right.
Like,
right.
Here's a pile of wrapped candy that's in a corner, and help yourself to taking one.
Right.
Like, what the hell is that?
Right.
Well, if you know what it is, it's one of the most powerful pieces you can imagine. Yeah. But otherwise, it's like, this is dumb.
Sure. Exactly. Well, and that's the, I think it's interesting, and I shouldn't be surprised at all, but these two approaches from opposite directions are seeking the same outcome, which is, like, how do we extend the conversation, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking, like, take away the judgment so everybody can talk, right? So everybody can
right.
feel free to say, like, here's an equal mm-hmm. experience.
Yeah.
With no knowledge and, you know, whatever it is. And yet your perspective is, you're still seeking the extension of the conversation. It's, you're almost saying, like, I don't like this, make me like it.
Yeah.
Right?
What if there's a, like, a practice field of disagreement where the thing you're disagreeing on is very low stakes?
Yeah, I believe in that.
There's this thing that happens at University of Chicago called the Lotka and Hamintash debate. Have you heard about this?
No.
So are you familiar with Lotka and Hamintashen?
I'm familiar with latkes. They're like the food?
Yeah.
Yeah. Food, the same thing?
It's like pastries. They're basically okay. like... Yeah, associated with holidays in the Jewish calendar. And every year at UChicago, they do this thing where they debate which one is better.
Yeah.
This has been going on for like 60 years.
Yeah.
And there's like people dress up in academic regalia. There's been like university presidents, Nobel yes. Prize winners, like, you know, absolute will come in from around the world. Full auditorium, and it'll be like several hours of the merits of one over the other.
Yes.
And it's all based on this concept of, like, giving a critique for the purpose of a response.
Yeah.
And the continued conversation. And, like, you know, it's the sort of thing that we'll presume it's been going on, like I said, for decades. It's never going to come to a a conclusion, a solution. Right. It's like, oh, we got it. Here it is. This is the answer.
Right.
And I think that's like the essence of what I think critique should be about.
Great. Yeah. And so in the spirit of find a way, that's it, right? Finding parameters that are set in order to enjoy a thing, right?
Yeah.
If it wasn't for the ridiculousness of the debate, mm-hmm. right? It could get serious.
Yeah.
It could get, you know, like egos could get involved. Totally. Identity could get involved, right?
Yeah.
Wars get started over
That's right.
things like stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
That is not a place that is not, I don't think there is a place for that.
Mm-hmm.
In a successful humanity.
Yeah.
But when it's, come on, guys, let's get all dressed up. We'll go and have this debate again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And let's really ham it up.
Mm-hmm.
And we all agree ahead of time, you know, there might not be a winner. Maybe someone wins this year, or somebody
yeah.
makes a really good argument this year, and next year we get an opposite.
And less serious because
right.
of that.
They take it seriously.
Like the arguments are legit arguments.
And they're the purpose is to exercise these muscles of debate and
right.
things like that. Whereas like one of my complaints with professional sports, where the idea behind a professional sport is like, let's see how far we can push the, you know, the human mind, the human body mm-hmm. to perform these feats, right?
Yeah.
I support that wholeheartedly. What I don't support is, you know, cheating so that we can win
sure.
or wishing for another team to like get an injury or, mm-hmm. you know,
right. yeah, yeah.
these like behind the scenes or underhanded ways of creating a victory
right.
as opposed to like, I'm going to set myself to the fullest measure
mm-hmm.
to see what I can do.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll win this time.
Right.
You know, that I can get behind. So it's all about the parameters. It's all about those foundations that you set before you start.
Mm-hmm.
I can get behind that.
Yeah. yeah. Right. Because the thing that's most fun to do is to talk to people who are really well informed, who are, you know, very omnivorous. And to hear what they have to say and then to say what I have to say.
Right.
I don't know. Isn't that just a normal thing that human people do?
Should be.
Okay.
It is. It's one of the reasons why I want to talk to you. It's one of the reasons why I want to record this conversation.
Yeah.
You know, is that this is one of those conversations.
Yeah.
This is what I want.
We should find something that we really disagree on.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think?
I don't know. It might take a while.
Do you have any like extreme views that you want to broadcast?
Yeah, I keep a notes app of all my extreme
views.
Let me just pull that up.
It's okay. We don't have to do it all on this one.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
I would consider my version of success with this project is I want to encourage ongoing investigation with people that I connect with the way I connect with you, right?
Hmm.
You're a standout among a lot of people because you have that quality that I love to find in a person, which is that sort of quick connection, right? You know, the first time we sat down to when we could really dig in and talk, I just had a blast right away.
Cool.
It wasn't
yeah.
hard. I didn't work for it.
Sure.
It wasn't a time where I was like, I have to find a way to enjoy this conversation. Right.
right.
It's nice. It was easy. Right. And so, you know, yeah, it'd be great if people got something from these conversations, if this podcast was successful, all those things, those mm-hmm. are wonderful. But, my only gauge for success on this is that like, I hope we do this again, you know, whether it's with a microphone or not, but
yeah.
You know, I, that's my goal really. And
yeah.
And then I feel like I already have a better sense of this concept from talking to you about it.
Cool.
Which is what I was hoping for. You know, I almost like, it's one of those things where I can feel the momentum of like, yeah, I think this is special. This is great because, you know, I'm learning already.
Oh, cool.
So
yeah,
I'm very, I'm grateful to you for that. And
man, thanks.
Yeah. Do you, okay. So one thing I want to ask,
yeah,
it's when we close is what is something that you're looking forward to that you're going to do that is going to help you like enjoy your life coming up? Mm-hmm. Like you were going to play golf and that got canceled.
Yeah.
So do you, what are you going to do instead of golf today? Or maybe it's not today. Maybe it's something else that you're feeling passionate about.
Yeah. I mean, I am looking forward to playing golf whenever we're able to reschedule that. I think we're going to try to do tomorrow or over the weekend.
Okay.
So that's a highlight. There's also going to be some really great golf on TV that I'm excited to watch.
Yeah.
Coming up.
Great. You got a favorite player?
I mean, I like Rory McIlroy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm kind of pulling for him.
Good.
But I like all the players. I just like the game. Like watching the game. Be cool to see Tiger do something.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be amazing.
Everybody likes a comeback.
Yeah, exactly. I'm looking forward to hanging out with the fam, seeing what they've been up to today, seeing what crazy thing my daughter is going to say.
Yeah.
That's going to be great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Okay, cool.
Thanks, Mike.
How about you? What are you looking forward to?
I'm feeling like I did, you know, I've been doing a lot of work for the podcast lately,
yeah.
And I haven't posted anything, but...
How many have you done now?
I've got 3 interviews now.
Okay, cool.
And I've done, I've made a couple of like solo, like blurbs.
Yeah, you mentioned you had recorded some of that stuff.
Okay. So I'm kind of riding high on this, just this feeling of getting some things done, making progress.
Oh, love that.
Sticking to it.
Yeah.
So tonight, I mean, like what I'm looking forward to now is like making dinner, mm-hmm. and,
cool.
Taking it easy. And then this weekend I'm, recording with a band called Thym, THYMN.
Oh.
With Jacob Adams and...
Oh, cool. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
That's exciting.
It's his project, yeah. And we've got a really killer little group for these songs that we're recording. We're going to do live recordings. We got Chris Hillman on drums and David Erickson on stand-up bass and Mark Archer on the dobro and Jacob. It's just like a really fantastic little... group we got together, and these songs are real, I don't know, they're just, they came together really quick, really easy.
Yeah.
You know, easy as in like just natural. And so we're going to sit in at Black Bear Studios this weekend and just take it easy, take our time, get some good live takes. And yeah,
that's great.
So I'm excited about that.
Can I ask you a recording question?
Sure.
And I don't know if this is something you want to have on the podcast, but what do you think of click tracks?
I think it's acquired taste. You know, I think depending on what you're trying to make, if you're trying to be precise, mm-hmm. and you're not doing a live take, as long as you can find a way to, I'm not even trying that time. As long as you can find a way to tap into the emotion that is required for playing the song.
Yeah.
Which I think is what gets in most people's way when it comes to a click track, is that it's very mechanical and it's very, mm-hmm. It doesn't have emotion to it. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's not alive so much.
Yeah.
So as long as you can tap into that, I think it's a great idea. And if not, you're trading one problem for another, right? Like if you go out of rhythm, if mm-hmm. you lose the tempo, you're just going to make the tracking harder on yourself later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? If you're doing tracking.
Yeah.
What is inherently good about having a song other than tracking? Like if you're just doing live
mm-hmm.
recording the whole time or it's a live performance, why does a song need to have a consistent tempo anyway?
They don't all. I mean, I don't think all songs have to.
Yeah.
I think if you're, like I have some songs where I deliberately change the tempo as I go.
Yeah.
I love, I have one song where I like at the end of each phrase, I slow down mm-hmm. and then I pick it back up again and I slow down. And it's not, there would be no way to even program a click to go with it because it changes and it's, you know,
yeah.
kind of, and so the purpose of the song is to fluctuate. Whereas if you're writing a song to make people dance,
okay,
then the click track, or at least that steady tempo mm-hmm. is really necessary. You're trying to, I think that there is and I don't know this, for sure. I don't know if I can like back this up with science or whatever, but,
yeah.
One of my experiences with listening to music is that there, I feel a synchronization with a song as I get into it. Right. And certain songs, like if I'm listening to like a James Brown song,
yeah.
there is something about that synchronization that makes me want to dance, right?
Totally.
It's almost like my heart starts beating with the song. Hmm. Like my mm-hmm. body is beating with it, right?
Right.
And so if you lose it, maybe the dancer wouldn't even notice cognitively, but
there'd be a feel.
You'd lose something yeah. about the feel,
right?
You know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really where it comes in. If you're just trying to create a consistency to like align yourself with whatever rhythm is inside the listener
yeah.
with your song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's people who have a lot of pretty strong opinions about the click track.
Sure.
Like if you don't play with a click practice or recording, like you're not, you're no good. It's interesting.
Yeah.
That's crazy that that's out there. I feel like for me personally, like I'm happy to play with a click.
Yeah,
but I would much rather just listen to the other musicians and let's all have a conversation and play together.
I certainly enjoy that more.
Yeah, and like I also get if this is a tracking situation and I'm laying down the drum track, like yeah, put the clicks in my ear. I need to maintain so that you can punch in, punch out, whatever. Yeah. I appreciate that, but it's always surprising to me when it's like. An ideology.
I agree.
Like, what? You don't play with a click? What's the matter with you?
And I think like that position is an example of our brain's inability to put into words what we're feeling, right? They're saying, what's the matter with you? But
right.
I feel like what they're really saying is like, this makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
And it would make me more comfortable if you did things the way I do things, you know?
Sure.
And they probably have some really good reasons for doing whatever it is that they do the way they do it.
Totally. Yeah.
Again, I think your instinct for compromise is the best. You know, like I've played in bands where the drummer listens to a click, mm-hmm. but we don't. We
right.
listen to the drummer.
Yeah.
You know? And if the drummer gets off the click, we don't know.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
it's the drummer's job to get back on the click or mm-hmm. to, you know, turn it off and just keep going.
Right.
I really think the best gauge is like, am I having fun?
I think so too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of my life mantra. Maybe not fun necessarily, but like, am I enjoying this?
Right.
Because otherwise, why am I doing it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's, I want more of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to seek that joy.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Good question.
Sweet.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Of course.
Okay. Did we do it?
Oh, I forgot to press record. Oh, no. Thanks so much for making your way here today. I just love that conversation with Mike. I can't tell you how much I appreciate his perspective and his willingness to go down certain avenues with me, even though he might disagree or have different feelings. And that was so refreshing to me. I really get excited by the idea of a safe space for debate, just for the sake of investigating, just for the sake of understanding. I think he's really onto something there, and I appreciate that he creates that space when he's in a room with me. So I look forward to having him back, if he'll come back. Maybe I'll even go play golf with him sometime. We'll see. In the meantime, I hope you're well. I hope you enjoyed yourself. And if you did, I would love for you to review and like and subscribe and doing all the things that help this little podcast out. Tell your friends, share with your neighbors and your family and your coworkers if you think they'd like it. Otherwise, just enjoy yourself. I know I did. That's really all I've got. One of these days, I'm going to come up with a tagline for the end. But until then, it's just going to be this rambling that I do. And there's nobody else in the room to press the stop button. So I just keep going until it fades to black, I guess. I've already outlasted the outro music, so I got that going for me. Yeah. I wonder how long I can keep this going. Well, tune in next Tuesday to find out. See you then.